This is XTP Media.
Well, it will be flying the Super Etendard from French carriers, which is really great for me and my development as a carrier pilot, and with the Queen Elizabeth class entering service in the next 5 years. That's just the kind of skill set I'll need to keep my flying going.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. For takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 104 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Lieutenant Commander Ian Sloan, Royal Navy, retired. Commander Sloan has a massive amount of experience flying everything from the Swordfish and the Seahawk to the Hawk, the Shah and the Harrier. But we were particularly interested to talk to Ian about his time as an exchange pilot with the French Navy flying the Super Etendard. You heard earlier an interview I undertook with Ian, or maybe over 8 or 9 years ago. That was when I first found out that he was going on exchange to the French Navy. So I decided, having crossed paths with Ian again, it'd be great to tell the whole of his career story so far. Ian calls me from Christchurch in New Zealand, so apologies for the quality of the line, and also a few apologies about some background noise at my end. Ian, welcome to Extended.
Thank you, Peter.
It's great to catch up with you again. As we just heard there, it was 8 or 9 years ago we last talked. Where did your passion for aviation start? How did that all happen?
So, Peter, really, flying is one thing that I've always really wanted to do. In fact, I grew up in the Scottish Borders, and during the 1980s there were low-flying jets flying around on a daily basis, really. And I was that kid in the school classroom. Whenever there was a hint of a jet engine flying by, I was glued to the window. And I think the teachers must have despaired at times. But it was one of those things. I just got bitten by that bug and joined the cadets, air cadets, as soon as I could, you know, flying the old chippy, a bit of gliding. And really, nothing I did kind of put me off, really. And I just seemed to be on that conveyor belt, dragging me ever closer. My dad was a local vet, and really, you know, I'm not from a military family at all. So he, of course, thinking, oh God, this boy wants to fly. I really, you know, what can I do except take him down the careers office? In fact, and of course, you want to learn to fly. The Air Force is a place to go. So I found myself filling in some paperwork and off down to Cranwell for a selection centre, and found myself with a scholarship, a sixth form scholarship with the Air Force, of all things. I don't talk much about that now, of course, but it's out there now, I guess. And so life was pretty much made. I thought, great, I'm in. Here we go. Off down to Cranwell when we finish school. None of this university nonsense. Away we go. Well, you know, we talk about sort of sliding doors moments, and one door closes, another one opens. Well, this was sort of early 90s, and the Air Force making huge number of cuts, getting rid of lots of aircraft, and of course not needing the pilots that it once was. So I found myself again down to Cranwell. Oh, thanks for coming, Mr. Sloan, but actually, the entry's full this year, so go and find something else to do, and we'll maybe call you back. So I thought, crikey, I've got to go and find something else to do now. University was the obvious choice, but of course, having hedged all my bets and joining the Air Force, I found myself scrabbling around clearing, trying to find a place at a university that was somewhere near an airfield so I could join the UAS at this stage.
Right, okay. And you hadn't lost then that link into wanting to be up in the air?
Not at all. So I ended up going off to Dundee into a civil engineering course, of all things, which really was so ill-suited to my sort of English and history schooling that it was almost laughable. But it was near Lucas, and so joined the University Air Squadron there. And over the 4 years of the degree, managed to get a reasonable amount of flying in fact. And obviously, back in the day, they were covering the elementary flying training syllabus on the old Bulldog. And so after 4 years of that, it was, right, let's see if the Air Force will have me again. But yeah. This time I was a bit older and wiser and thought, you know, maybe just have a backup plan here. And so whilst I was diligently filling out the application form for the Air Force, I'd also still gone out for the Navy as well, thinking, you know, the Navy's not that bad. The fleet, I've got a few jets and, you know, a lot of helicopters. So there's probably a chance if it all goes wrong, we could get involved there. I managed to avoid filling out the form for the Army. That just seemed too much like camping.
Yeah, of course, of course. So obviously the dice was rolled and it fell on the Fleet Air Arm.
Well, yes, I think the Air Force at the time, again, I think they had plenty of pilots and they said, well, thanks for applying. You could be a navigator. How about that? It didn't take me too long to turn that down. And in the meantime, the process with the Navy was going through and sure enough, well done, you've passed the selection board, expect to join in January. So having left university in, it would have been the July, I joined the Navy the following January.
Yeah. And what did you go in as?
So joined as a graduate entrant. So initially a sub-lieutenant on qualifying after graduating from Dartmouth.
Right. Okay. So tell us about your flying training then in the Navy.
So the Navy was quite a fun experience at Dartmouth. I remember very fond memories of Dartmouth, in fact, and we'd go back there tomorrow, really. A lot of Air Force pilots I speak to would quite happily avoid Cranwell, which probably speaks volumes to the place. I ended up doing a year, which was pretty standard, at Dartmouth, and the final term there, in fact, the final 14 weeks is what we call the professional term, which would be flight term. So that's 14 weeks where all the aviators are grouped together in the same class and left to do their professional studies, they call it, which for us really means flying grading on the Grob, which is our first taste of naval aviation, really. And that was conducted down at Plymouth at the time. And a very quick, I think it's 13 hours of flying to reach a standard where the examiner can decide whether you're worth the risk or worth a safe bet to send off to elementary flying training to pass that course.
Yeah, and that, how did you find it? What were you like as a fledgling pilot?
Well, I think the statistics are probably a bit skewed, Peter, on account of the fact that I already had a PPL and 120 hours of flying the Bulldog under my belt by that stage as well. And there were probably five or six pilots in the same sort of boat who, funny old thing, had been offered navigator by the Air Force and said, no thanks, joined the Navy instead. Yeah. And so a good little team there of hardworking guys who, you know, didn't find it too challenging. And perhaps that was the problem, and we'll come on to it really, where things did change a little bit for me in smashing through.
Mm. Okay.
But we finished at Dartmouth, and then the first thing I did actually after that was go and hold an 899 squadron, which at the time was the Sea Harrier conversion unit.
Yeah. How did that feel getting posted to that? I'm sure some of your colleagues got posted elsewhere.
Well, that's right.
Great feeling.
I don't think there was really any sort of skill or judgment involved, really. It was simply the job of a poor flight training officer whose job it was to find homes for out of out of work pilots, you know, waiting courses, to just throw them somewhere for a month at a time and get them doing something useful. So
you're too humble.
Yeovilton tend to be, obviously, Yeovilton or Caldroz being the two naval air stations.
Yeah,
they tended to bear the brunt. And you know, if you had a particular bent one way or other, then the man was more likely to oblige and try and get you somewhere you wanted to go. And you know, certainly with a kind of a sideways glance at jets, you know, it's kind of, you know, there might be a chance I could do this. Getting a look at 899 and spending a month there was really good value. And you know, in hindsight, the number of young pilots in training that spent time with 899 and indeed the two frontliners, it's amazing how many of those came back through as fixed wing pilots themselves.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us about converting to the Harrier then.
Well, of course, we've been through flying training on the Tucano and the Hawk in the meantime, and I managed that pretty quickly, in fact. I found myself back at 899 three and a half years after stepping through the front gate at Dartmouth, which is pretty quick, really. I think I managed 3 weeks off between Tucano and Hawk courses. And in fact, I left Valley a week early to join my start date at Yeovilton. So really flashed through flying training quite quickly. And yeah, just scraped through onto the standard to make the Sea Harrier course. But yeah, you can arrive at Yeovilton and, you know, you walk down the corridor in 899 squadron with all the old course photos on, and you're very aware of the pedigree and the shoes that you're stepping into. The Sea Harrier world is, you know, a great little club, fantastic history and, you know, set of pedigree. You just feel that as you're walking around the unit, in fact.
Yeah. And who were the sorts of characters around at that time?
Well, we had, crikey, the sort of legendary guys, Jack London, Rob Schwab, were the sort of instructors, long in the tooth, but they were probably coming to the end of their days, perhaps. We had Dave Mackay was the squadron boss at the time.
Right,
in fact,
okay,
he'd been there. In fact, he just started his time as the CEO as I arrived to hold straight out of Dartmouth. So we talked again about how to navigate the world of flying training, which certainly stood me in good stead for sure.
So tell us about the learning to fly the Harrier, because it's a unique aircraft. How did that go?
Well, it is a complex airplane, and you know, it will do you a disservice as soon as look at you, really. When we arrived, in fact, this was again early 2000s, and the decision had been made to move all the Sea Harriers up to Cottesmore and Wittering to be part of the Joint Force 2000, which would be the Sea Harriers and the Harriers all working together, being very pally and matey, and working together on the ship, off the ship, all being great. Well, this turned into a bit of a damp squib, and that decision was reversed. Unfortunately, what hadn't been reversed was the fact that the simulator had been taken apart and put on the back of a truck to take up to Cottesmore. So, as if flying the Harrier wasn't tricky enough, we actually had no simulator for the first half of our course. It involved a few extra two seat trips just to get us going. And, you know, I kind of think now, what on earth, you know, we'd make of that in this risk-averse world we live in.
Yeah, of course. So what was your first solo flight like?
First solo in the shower was, I think I had a smile on my face the whole time, to be honest. because it really was a rocket ship. We had every takeoff we'd done thus far, and I think we'd probably done three two-seat sorties with an instructor before being unleashed. They'd all been in a fully fueled two-seater, which, you know, the performance of that is eye-watering enough. But then for your first solo, they half fill a Sea Harrier to internal fuels only, and it really does go off like a rocket, really. So by the time you figure out where you are, you're already through 5,000 feet and barely able to stay in the overhead. But great fun. And, you know, the old jet was just so responsive. It really did. every jet I was fortunate to fly, you know, you go through flying training from the Tucano. It's nice and stable, nice training airplane. You go to the Hawk and it's suddenly a bit fightery and it's got swept wings and you got to pull it around corners and stuff. Well, suddenly you get to the two-seat Harrier and, wow, this is amazing. It's, you know, so responsive. And then even on top of that, the single-seater, the fighter, is just another step above. And, you know, I was really fortunate to have that sort of progression to a really, you know, a fight that you feel, you know, a real modern-day Spitfire, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah. And so how long was the training at the OCU and where did you go to first?
So the OCU took about a year, and that was really to get through the sort of two phases. The first half was all about flying the airplane, all the usual stuff like handling, involved a trip to Wittering for all the pads and the strips in terms of Harrier handling the V-stall stuff there.
Yeah. That wasn't done at Yeovilton?
No, so we do our initial conversion at Yeovilton, do our initial press-ups and hovering there, and then once we are sufficiently skilled at that, we'll deploy as a maybe even a whole squadron, in fact. But certainly for the V-stall phase to really maximise the use of the strips and the pads at Wittering, which we didn't have at Yeovilton, right. Just to really, really embed those V-stall skills in us.
Yeah, okay. So where was the first posting then, Ian?
So from conversion, I then went to 801 Squadron. And that, again, just across the dispersal, really, from 899. And one of the first things we did, in fact, was head off to HMS Ark Royal to do a carrier qual, which was a fun couple of weeks. Lots of bouncing around, finding a way around the ship in the first place, and even landing on it a couple of times as well.
Right. Wow. So operations, where did you fly the Harrier? Hours, that sort of thing?
So gosh, Sea Harrier, I did about 600 hours in total in the Sea Harrier. The first year, we were pretty much land-based, and we went all over the place. So really, Europe and the States were the big areas we hit. We'd do a lot of trials out in the States where we couldn't use the British areas, for example, and where we needed specific equipment that the Americans would be using for us. And I've tucked away there. That was great fun. And in the second year, we were really embarked on HMS Invincible as she came out of refit. And that was really good, building that team up as the ship built itself up out of refit, a fresh crew, some of them never been on an aircraft carrier before, gradually coming together as a team. Then we introduced the airplanes. We got ourselves all familiar with the deck again and started taking part in a few more exercises leading up really to the operational readiness inspection.
Yeah.
And that's where the FOSS staff embark and put us through our paces.
Right. And that experience came back very valuably later in your career, of course. But where did you operate the Shah?
So in the Shah, with HMS Invincible, we spent a lot of time up the North Sea, down the Eastern Atlantic, down to the Azores. And then the highlight really was the Westland cruise, which basically takes us to the eastern seaboard of the US.
Yeah, wow. Okay, cool.
Particular highlight for me there was as we got to the east coast of the States, we disembarked two jets. I and our squadron warfare instructor, in fact, ferried across to the west coast of the States where we did a missile firing. And I took part in one of the last AMRAAM firings from a Sea Harrier.
Wow. In 2004. Tell us about that. Tell us about it.
Well, it was a bit of a story, in fact, all told, really. And without dragging out too long, just getting across the west coast was a bit of a challenge. Leaving the ship in the first place, classically the ship had found a fog bank in the east off the eastern seaboard there, and we seemed to spend a whole day just stooging around trying to find a break in this fog before somebody had the wise idea that actually we weren't planning to return to it anyway. So in invisibility, where we couldn't see the ramp when we slammed, we got airborne and out of this fog bank and ashore into Bangor, Maine to meet a tanker.
Wow.
Unfortunately, we got the jets to Bangor. The pair of us jumped in the crew bus, taking us to the hotel for the night. And as we were getting into the hotel, the heavens opened. Right. Now in the Sea Harrier, the starter solenoid is in the left-hand cheek panel of the intake and was quite prone. If it wasn't protected, it could get very wet. And we kind of had this moment looking at each other thinking, we probably should have taped up that starter panel, shouldn't we? So classically, we got back to the jets the next morning and thought, you know, let's maybe just try starting the jets, see if we can get them going. And sure enough, mine started, but my wingman's didn't. And so the Air Force, who always seem to have a low opinion of Navy pilots anyway, were more than a little shocked when we took this little circuit board across them and said, can you put this in your oven for half an hour at gas mark 6?
Wow. I just can't imagine that sort of thing happening these days.
Well, it does seem like a different lifetime. It really does feel like a different age.
And firing the AMRAAM, Ian?
Yeah, so that was a shot against a Phantom, an F4, so radio controlled, I might add.
Yeah.
Wow. And you know, we had very, you know, it can be quite stressful occasions, really, these live firings, because the test points are so critical to, you know, well, we think the missile can do this, and the makers are saying it can do that, and we want to prove what we think is right, and we want to prove what they think is right, and understand more about the missile. That's why we do it.
Yeah.
So it was great fun, a little bit of stress involved, but to watch the missile go off the rail was pretty incredible. It's a big old missile coming off a little jet.
I was going to say, how does the aircraft respond when the missile's running? Do you feel it?
Certainly there was a little bit of you feel the blast as the missile goes off, but really, other than that, you're manoeuvring the airplane in any case, and so it's perfectly under control, and there's no real wild reaction at all.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
And was it visual or?
I didn't see it. No.
No.
Wow. I didn't see it. No, it was beyond visual range.
Yeah.
but it was quite interesting because we were there firing our last ever missiles, our last AMRAAM off the Sierra, whilst the Tornado F3 team were there doing their first ever live shots. So there was obviously a good bit of banter between the
the two trades, as it were. Now, you also got to fly GR9.
So after the Sea Harrier, I went off to instruct at Valley as the whole migration of Navy Harrier pilots or Sea Harrier pilots moved across to the Harrier GR9. And I found myself rolling up there and, converting to the GR9. As much as it's a Harrier, it's a very different airplane, really. It hovers. It's capable of landing in very confined spaces. We could take it on board and all that good stuff. But really, it's a very dedicated air-to-ground platform instead of the probably air-to-air heavy Sea Harrier.
And is that the aircraft that you were flying in Afghanistan?
That's right. And there was, at the time, the real operational tempo around the force was quite amazing. In fact, if a squadron wasn't on leave, winding down from having just been in Afghanistan, another one was winding up, getting itself operationally current again. And the third, if not actually in Afghanistan, probably on its way back. And then, of course, there's the demands of the ships that want Harriers embarked on top of that. It was a very busy place with limited assets, shall we say, because, of course, the real focus was Afghanistan and making sure that the operation was kept up.
Yeah. And what sort of operations were you involved in on Operation Herrick?
So primarily the job there flying out of Kandahar was supporting the guys on the ground, really. And we'd have some standing patrols. We'd have a pair of aircraft airborne in the morning. We'd have another pair scheduled to fly in the afternoon. But all the way through the day, we'd have an alert aircraft as well, a pair of aircraft on alert, ready to scramble for any emerging issues, really. Troops in contact, for example, where there wasn't already an airborne pair that could go and react to that.
Yeah.
So really satisfying stuff, and professionally a really rewarding time of my career, actually. So many pilots never really get the chance to do the job for real. They train and train and train, and you know, they can miss out on doing the job for real. So a really professionally rewarding time there, even the more so because what we'd find was that the troops that we were helping out on the ground, we'd always transit back through Kandahar. So more often than not, they'd come in and just stop by and, you know, talk to us about, you know, that time that we helped them out, and talking on the radio, and we did a show of force, so we did drop a bomb or shoot some rockets and really help them out. So really, really good, rewarding time there.
And still to come on Extended.
And bizarrely, one of my experiences as a young Sea Harrier pilot was leading a mission against, I think, 6 or 12 Super Etendards all trying to sink the ship, and we just completely monstered the whole package and had a great day out for fighter pilots.
Are you fascinated by aviation and its history? Are you hungry to expand your knowledge? Then you're ready for The Aviation Historian. A compact format quarterly journal, The Aviation Historian is a cross between a magazine and a book. It uses the best authors and the best picture sources to explore the less well-known paths of the history of flying. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey, that's me, and Nick Stroud, so you can trust it for quality, accuracy, and sheer passion for the subject. The Aviation Historian. We're print, we're digital, but we're not in the shops. Order us online and find out more at theaviationhistorian.com. Are you ready for it?
This is Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast.
Now, I want to talk briefly about your time back in the UK when I met you at the end of, but you were commanding the, what was the Royal Navy Heritage Flight. You got the opportunity to fly some fantastic aircraft there, didn't you?
That's right. So from the Harrier, I went back down to Yeovilton, and initially I was on the staff on fixed wing standards flight, naval flying standards.
Yep.
Flying the Hawk as the sort of standards pilot, the examiner there. And that allowed me to fly all manner of things, really. And whilst I was in that job, I introduced into the historic flight, flying a Seahawk initially, and displaying that, which is, again, where I met one of your partners in crime, Gareth Stringer.
Yeah, that's right.
It was my first air show, in fact. I bumped into him. It was very quick at saying hello and getting involved, which was very nice of him, making me feel at home that way.
Yeah.
But I came to the end of my time on fixed wing standards, and with no Harriers to go back to, again, that sort of sliding doors moment, you know, one door closing. Oh, crikey, where am I going to go now? And so it happened that the historic flight was needing somebody to be in charge. And from a cast of probably one, I was the one in the right place at the right time. And lucky old me got involved in that. So
you got to fly the Seahawk. Did you fly any of the other aircraft? I can't remember.
So aside from the Seahawk, obviously I did a lot of time in the Chipmunk, and then got into the Swordfish as well. That was my, and I didn't actually display the Swordfish, and it was always a juggle trying to maximize those hours to make sure that the display pilots got enough flying to be current. And at the end of the season there, I managed to snaffle a few hours to convert to the airplane.
Yeah.
And actually, I had just converted to, just got back into the Swordfish, at the start of the next season, when actually the doctors got a hold of me and tracked me down and stopped me from flying for a wee while, which kind of put the kibosh on a lot of plans for that year for me, because that would have been quite a nice progression to try and get into the CFURI and help old Chris Scottcout.
Yeah.
Which unfortunately didn't come to pass.
I didn't know that you hadn't got to fly the CFURI, actually.
No, I sometimes jumped in the back with Chris just to keep him on the straight and narrow. Not that I could offer him that much advice, but no, I would sometimes go away with Chris sitting in the back. So got to see it and understand what on earth he was talking about. But never actually got to fly it properly and get into it.
Right,
was then, of course, the next chapter in my career coming along.
Yeah, absolutely. So how did that unfold?
Well, like all good flying stories, Peter, this one started in the bar. And this was, as boss of the historic flight, I was down at the Fleet Air Arms CEOs conference, of all things. So it sounds a bit grander than it is, but we were in the bar that evening and chatting to an old boss of mine who at this stage was running around trying to find some a fixed-wing part to go out to France. And he's talking to me and saying, well, you know, if you want somebody to go out to France, I'll go. And with that throwaway line, not realizing quite the trouble it would get me in. That was probably the Thursday night in a barn called Rose. And come the Monday morning back at Yeovilton, I had my boss on the phone. So hey, Sloane, you need to speak to the pointer. This sounds like you're off to France. So phone call with
what was the background to wanting a pilot to go to France then, Ian?
Well, with the loss of the Harrier, really we were starting to struggle to find jobs for fixed-wing pilots in the Navy, and very conscious that the long game for us was the F-35 arriving on the scene. Very clear that we need to retain a maritime pilot experience, an experienced cadre. The Navy had kind of sent out the message loud and clear to basically anybody that operated aircraft from carriers. And of course, the US Navy were very keen to oblige. And by far and away, the majority of pilots that are now in the F-35 are pilots who will have gone through an American F-18 exchange, probably, if not gone straight into the aircraft. But the French Navy were very keen as well to oblige. And back in the day, back in the 70s, really, when we had old Dark Royal with cats and traps, there was a Buccaneer exchange to the old Etendard 4 flying off the Foch and Clemenceau. And this was really almost revitalizing that old relationship. And, you know, we'd bounced along with the French Navy for many years, and we kind of waxed and waned. We'd kind of had a fight with them. Then we'd not do anything for months, and then we'd think, oh, can we do another wee exercise and come and try and attack the ship kind of thing. And bizarrely, one of my experiences as a young Sea Harrier pilot was leading a mission against, I think, 6 or 12 Super Etendards, all trying to sink the ship. And we just completely monstered the whole package and had a great day out for fighter pilots.
Ian, is that because of the history of the Falklands? Was that the reasoning behind that, or to retest that technology and flying skills?
Well, I think it's simply because the Super Etendard remained a viable threat, really, for us. And, you know, for a Navy that was very much, scarred, in fact, scarred by its experience in the Falklands of not having that look down overland radar, you know, that airborne early warning. It's something that we want to practice and show that actually, you know, we have absolutely killed that demon. You know, we are no longer going to suffer from that. And, you know, the whole reason the CRFA-2 with a great radar came out was to counter those sort of things, with the Sea King ASAC as well out there helping us. And, you know, it was almost, you know, guys, this is now no longer a thing we have to worry about, because we've got these assets and we can manage quite nicely.
Yeah. Okay. So converting to a new type, a very special type, but there's the whole life experience of moving to a new culture, a new language, let alone a new aircraft.
Oh, you're way ahead of me there, Peter. So classically, on the Thursday night in the bar led to the Monday morning, which led put in chain a series of events that classically, you know, seemed to be perpetually part of my naval career, and I arrive somewhere first, and the paperwork catches up with me.
Yeah.
But yeah, right. Okay, so we need to get you onto language course. That starts then. Right. In fact, we need to get somebody into the historic flight to replace you. Okay, we need to sort that out. Go and do language course. Oh yeah, you probably need to find a house somewhere and stuff. So there was this crazy period in her life where I managed to cram in a 10-week language course to be able to survive, and I laugh even now. I laugh that I was apparently given survival level French when I was going to be catapulted off the front of their carrier. Find a place to live. So we did a quick weekend, or it was a week. We found a spare week to go and do a quick recce around Brittany and find a house, and that actually seemed to go pretty swimmingly. Kids were in school suddenly. That's great. It's all go. The movers got everything across. And we seemed to arrive in fairly good order. And yeah, pitched up on day one in France, in Land of Visio.
Right, okay.
And so, like, so you say, it's a different culture, different world, really different place. But the nearest military air base to Land of Visio is indeed Col d'Rose. So I did feel that actually, if anything went that badly wrong, I wouldn't be far away from finding some help somewhere.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about the Super Entendard. How did your conversion to that aircraft start?
So the Super Entendard was in the process of being retired and replaced by the Rafale in the French Navy. And so the conversion unit had been disbanded. And in fact, the conversion flight within the last squadron had also been disbanded, because the last two students had come back from their training in America and already progressed through that system. And so I arrived, and some very garlic shrugs, and dust off some documents here and there, say, right, this is what we're going to do. And it really was quite a nice conversion, in fact. The first thing I did with them was a sort of welcome to France orientation course in a Falcon. So they keep
Falcon 10.
Falcon 10 MERs, which are sort of communications machines, really. Very similar to what we used the Jetstream for back in the day at Yeovilton. But we also do an instrument rating in the Falcon prior to starting on the Super Etendard. So we were doing a bit of instrument flying, a little bit of procedural stuff, a bit of low-level flying in the Falcon, which was quite good fun. And then into the simulator. Here we go. 10 simulator sessions. Right, we're off and running, and off you go getting the jet. And
Ian, can I ask a practical question? I mean, while you're in the Falcon and then into the simulator, were you talking French? Were you speaking French? All the controls and the buttons and lights, are they all labelled in French? Did you have to learn all of those?
Everything was in French. Everything, absolutely, Peter. I got past as best I could. At the end of the day, I would revert to English quite quickly if things were not going as we thought. But yeah, all the air traffic was in French. I'd sometimes disappear off to a civilian airfield over in Rennes, in fact, on a diversion, just to get some air traffic controllers who spoke English, so I could actually just stop my mind racing around for a bit. All the manuals were in French. So I'd be sitting there with in a classroom in a class of one, these tech instructors would be just spend the morning with me rattling through, and they were non-commissioned officers whose level of English was not great, and between us we're kind of, you know, nodding and smiling and pointing, and we seemed to make it work. But you know, I think one thing I found was that my experience on historics in getting into new airplanes and being able to get it going and feeling fairly comfortable quite quickly certainly helped an awful lot with this.
Yeah, okay.
There's no question of that.
So stepping into the cockpit, single-seater?
Single seat. There are no two-seat Super Etendards, Peter. Yep. So, yeah, single seat is, you know, don't want to waste an airframe on two seats, gee whiz. yeah, now the first four or five sorties were actually all chased by a second aircraft, which was a very bizarre situation. And I guess, you know, if you're French, it's completely normal. But for me, it was just a little bit strange. And there were lots of little details that I just had to make doubly sure that I understood properly, you know, just make sure things weren't lost in translation. And the first exercise, for example, sortie one, right, we're going to climb to 40,000 feet and we're going to go supersonic, and then we're going to come back and do some aeros, and we're going to come back to the circuit and we're going to land. So just confirm you said we're going to go supersonic. Yes. You know, the airframe, actually the Super Etendard really has the same sort of performance envelope as the Hawk, which made it pretty comfortable. Right. So it's almost identical, in fact, which is why the whole, you know, supersonic, you say, first sortie, we're going to do that. because in the Hawk, you know, it will go supersonic, but you've got to be in a dive pointing at the Earth and with full power on and really going for it. Well, so is the same with the Super Etendard.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
Sure enough, off we went, climbed to 40,000 feet and pointed at the Earth and went supersonic. And there we go. Right, we've done it. Can we go on now? but that was a funny little addition to what I thought would be a fairly routine kind of sortie one, just getting used to the airplane.
Sorry to interrupt you there. I was reading some of your notes, an article that I think you were interviewed for a good few years ago about, is it FAM3, the incident for FAM3?
Yeah. Yes. So, FAM is a familiarization 3.
Right.
The third sortie in the airplane. And the jet has a stick shaker, which is, you know, basically a warning that you're approaching the stall. Yeah. And I had seen in an embarked period before I converted that one of the pilots went off the front and his stick shaker actually activated inadvertently, and which is not what you want, got off the front, because obviously you have to unload a little bit, take a bit of back pressure off the stick, which could potentially point you back to the ocean. He was pretty sharp and managed to flick off, turn the system off and fly away quite nicely. So I had this same malfunction on my third trip. And as I rotated off the main runway at Landivisio, this stick shaker just started shaking away. It's, oh, here we go. And classically, we reached a point where we were too fast to actually stop. And, you know, I had a guy behind me chasing as well. So if I'd kind of aborted, he'd be in the back of me in any case. And so I was in this situation where, you know, nudging forward, you know, a quick another pullback to get away from the ground, because that was another concern at the time. The jet pitched down a bit more. Just managed to switch it off and hit the switch off in at the right time, and away we went. So that was an introduction to things going wrong quite quickly.
And of course, in another language, dealing with all of that, quite stressful, I would have thought.
It took a bit of concentration, that's for sure. Peter, that is, how do I tell him? This is, you know, what's the word for this? And of course, you know, you start those early sorties, the weather's got to be a certain standard. And of course, while we were dumping fuel to get back to landing weight, a shower had come across the airfield, so we ended up doing instrument approach and him on the wing. It was just it's one of these really, you know, simple problems that became really quite interesting a little bit of management just to sort out.
Right, okay. So qualified on the aircraft, You were with the French Navy for 2 years?
So 2 years. And it was an interesting time because I arrived and the opening gambit, in fact, when I arrived in my chat with the air wing commander was, great to have you here, Sloane, but we're not sure we've got the hours now that we can convert you to the airplane.
Yeah.
And so that prompted me to make a few phone calls and send a few emails back to Portsmouth and Navy Command and say, hey, you fellas, what's going on? I'm going to give up a pretty good job for this. yeah. At which point, a few days later, I went, oh, okay, we've managed to find some hours from somewhere and we'll get you enough for a carrier call. Oh, well, that's okay. Yeah. So really, my conversion course basically became the vehicle to give me enough hours so that I could go to the ship and qualify on the Charles de Gaulle.
Wow.
Which was pretty, it was a pretty tasty timeline, really, because the minimum was 60 hours on type before you go to the ship. And the average ab initio student would have double that anyway, having completed the entire conversion course. And he would also have done a previous carrier qualification in the Goshawk out in the States as part of his flying training before coming back to France. So this really was a very condensed, right, we're going to get you comfortable with the aircraft and we're going to go straight into our carrier landing practice ashore. So ASSPs, they call them, pontage sur piste, was the name they gave them. But it was a very aggressive timeline, and it was real hard work and a second language, really challenging stuff, just to get a head around that at times.
Yeah.
But off we went down to the south of France, embarked in the ship, and away we went. And it was six landings, I think it was, and qualified, get a nice patch, and away you go. And I did a little bit more on top, just I think they felt sorry for me hanging around looking a bit lonely, so we'll give you a couple more. But classically, that was a period, there's a month dedicated to a training period, which 2 weeks of that will be carrier qualifications for all new pilots, and that's Rafale, Superintendard was the last one, and the E2 as well. And then the next half of that is a national exercise to basically bring the ship back up to operational readiness as well.
Yeah.
And that then they embark the headquarters staff, the battle staff as well. So quite a busy time, really, and it can get quite frenetic.
Yeah. Okay. And were you sort of on your own, or were you part of the operation of the ship, or were you attached to a squad, to a French squadron?
So very much part of the squadron at this time. So 17 flotille, that's the 17 squadron of French Navy. And absolutely part of that squadron for that period. Got my carrier qualification, went back to Landivisio, and they were really, and it was really touching, actually, how keen they were to give me a final flight.
Yeah.
About a month after I'd flown the jet previously, he said, right, we've got your final flight then, Sloane. And holy, I've not flown this jet for a month now. I don't know if this is possibly the most dangerous thing I'm ever going to do now. But was a really, really wonderful way to finish, actually. And it's a flight that sticks in my memory to this day. We did a high-level transit across to Le Havre, and then flew down the Normandy beaches at 1,000 feet, just enjoying the scenery there, looking down the beaches. Then from the western end of the Normandy beaches, just low level down south through Brittany, and then back up the western coast at 100 feet over the sea, and into smash breaking land, and then of course being French, bit of champagne on reception. So really a really lovely way to end, and it was a really good bunch of guys that I enjoyed spending my time with there. Some really good mates
who
looked after me very well.
So flying the Super Entendard, you know amazing set of aircraft behind you prior to that, how did that fit in, where did it fit in terms of skill set and ease of flight?
So it's not a terribly difficult airplane to fly. Very, very similar wing to a Hunter, possibly, in the grand scheme of things. So very comfortable at low level. And really low down, it was very, very nice. Flying over the sea at low level, as they like to remind me, you know, oh, yeah, the Navy knows all about the Super Endar flying low-level attacks against the ships. In terms of vintage, you know, Sea Harrier, contemporary, very much, you know, a nice radar, absolutely, but still very much steam-driven. Gauges and very analog. The pilots were starting to fly with a tablet on their knees, so a bit more tactical display there. But really, yeah, the airplane was, you know, it's a 1970s jet.
Sure.
Which, I mean, the Sea Harrier really was. Performance-wise, I kind of said already, really, very similar to the Hawk flight envelope. Twice as heavy, but had twice the power. So, you know, very, very similar. And, you know, I certainly enjoyed the Hawk, and I certainly enjoyed the Super Endar as well.
Yeah. And that experience was brought home to your last role in the Navy. And just want to catch up on that before we talk about where you are now and the last part of the journey so far. You mentioned the F-35. What was your role in bringing the F-35 and Queen Elizabeth into service?
Yeah, so really to capitalize on my experience in France, I came back to Navy Command, and the role really was part of the carrier capability delivery team. So the Queen Elizabeth capability delivery team, bringing the ship into service, but as the single fixed wing pilot in Navy Command, to actually impart knowledge and wisdom, understand what F-35 could do, and ultimately what the ship needed to be fitted with and fitted for to really make the most of that. In some cases, you know, what we need in the ship just to be able to land the aircraft on the carrier in the first place. So it was really, you know, as far as ground jobs, you know, staff appointments go, one of the better ones, in that it, basically I was a bit of a nuisance around every level in Navy Command, in fact, because there wasn't one real part of the Navy that the F-35 is not going to touch on, whether it's information flow, whether it's engineering, whether it's logistics. You know, everybody's involved in getting the ship to sea and the aircraft onto the ship. One of the little jewels that we had was my post had direct feed into British airspace up in Wharton, where we had the F-35 sim and the Queen Elizabeth Flyco simulator as well. So every month or so I'd go off on a little road trip up to Blackpool and jump in the simulator, which was really almost cathartic for a desk-bound pilot to be able to jump in this sim and just get a little fix for a week at a time, but just working procedures and gradually feeding in, you know, advice from the guys that are flying aircraft in the States. So again, there's likes of Nath Gray over in Pax River, who was developing the airplane. You know, right, Nath, how does this airplane fly? What procedures do we need to get it back onto the ship? You know, it would have been very easy to get the old Invincible manuals out and just delete Harrier or Sea Harrier and replace with F-35. But we made the decision quite early that, you know, we've got a blank canvas here. Let's do things the best possible way we can for a new class of ship and a new airplane.
Wow, amazing. So, Ian, I'm speaking to you today. You're in New Zealand. It's your evening. It's my morning. How did you end up in New Zealand?
Well, I had the good fortune to marry well, and my better half is a Kiwi. So it was a sort of understanding that we'd have all the fun in the world in the Navy, and then actually we'd come back to New Zealand for the kids to grow up in a fantastic place to live, really. It's all working so far, dare I say. We're set up quite nicely in a town called Nelson. So you could argue that's shocking lack of no imagination at all from a naval officer to retire to a town called Nelson. But joined Air Nelson flying the Q300, the Dash 8, on the regional network around New Zealand. And that's a pretty healthy little living at the moment. So we're quite happy with that. And we're just enjoying life, really.
And you're instructing again as well.
So, yes, I'm not instructing as a flying instructor, but I'm teaching human factors to all the airline pilots and flight attendants. Quite early on, my experience was kind of noted that I'm not just the average first officer kind of candidate, and that I've probably got a little bit of experience that I can, you know, at least maybe talk about how things can go badly wrong quite quickly in old airplanes, and the human factor can sometimes be the difference there.
And enjoying it? What do you, we're in a very crazy world at the moment. Is there any other plans for Ian and his flying career after this?
Well, at the moment, I'm just keeping my head down, to be honest. Happy to have a job. Again, you know, who knows what doors will open for me next. Certainly one thing that's happened is there's a big slowdown. And whilst 6 months ago, it looked like there was quite a straightforward progression for me to cross the cockpit in the Dash 8 to command that for a while before going to the jet fleet and end up with Air New Zealand proper and doing the big jet stuff, which was quite attractive. That's kind of ground to a halt now. So, just having a look at some options at the moment, really, Peter. Nothing is off the table, really. I'm quite happy flying around at the moment, but there's just not much of it, is the thing.
No, understand. So looking back over your Navy career, Ian, what the standout moments? I mean, Shah, you know, the Harrier, the Super Entendard, fantastic experiences. Anything in particular?
Well, look, you've probably touched on it there. In fact, really, there are little periods in my career that I look back on, and every phase, if you like, has got its little standout moments, flights that I'll never forget kind of thing, whether it's, you know, Nightcrawl and the Sea Harrier firing the missile, the AMRAAM was a big deal there, historics-wise, crikey, displaying the Sea Hawk at Farnborough. You know, the Duxford displays that we did, you know, flying around with a Sea Fury and a Sea Fire on the wing, you know, really memorable stuff like that. Just flying the Swordfish, frankly. Carrier Qual and the Super Etendard certainly was a big thing, and I really enjoyed that. I look back and think, you know, there's pretty much nothing I haven't done. In a military airplane, so I'm pretty happy that I've kind of left that life now and gone, right, okay, I can get on with, you know, the other stuff, you know, the quiet retirement, yeah, says is
the family.
I don't feel there's no pang of regret there that we've moved and got away from that. It was great fun, and if I had my time again, crikey, I'd be there in a shot. But you know, people often ask me now, say, oh, would you go back? And say, well, crikey, I think I'm getting a bit old for that now.
Understand.
So we'll see.
Yeah. Okay, two final questions. One a practical one. Best food, French Navy or the Royal Navy?
Oh, no, this is a good one. You've stumbled into a wonderful question there, Peter. So, and this does sum up the difference between the navies, actually. You don't know quite what you've done here. So in the Royal Navy, the standard of food is pretty consistent, and it's actually a good standard. You will never go hungry, and you'll always go, right, I'm going to have a decent meal tonight, and it's going to be good. And actually, when it comes to it, the chefs will dig out and produce the goods if needs must.
Yeah.
The French Navy, I can honestly say I have never eaten as well on board a ship. Or as badly on board a ship.
Okay. Oh, I didn't expect that.
So we did, with Charles de Gaulle, we were in the Gulf and we were at sea, in fact, for both Christmas and New Year, which was quite unusual. But Christmas Eve at sea was just the most fantastic steak. And as you'd expect, watered down nicely with some good claret, a good Bordeaux, and they did the job very nicely indeed there. I just flabbergasted. But the next day, of course, you had the B team on, and it was basically a plate of beans. And I just watched people just get up in disgust and leave the table. So, on balance, you know, I'd probably stick with what you know.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. Okay, and then final question. I can't go without saying, what have you got on Mr. Stringer? He seems to be so worried about. He keeps saying, "Don't let us lonely on about anything to me." So, it's a shame he couldn't make the call, but he's working today. But
I'll always remember first meeting Gareth. It was my first display in the Seahawk, and he'd gone to huge trouble to organise this nice little photo, a group photo of the RAF displays at Liverpool Airport. So I think it was a Typhoon, it was a King Air and maybe a Tucano or a Hawk, something like that, all in this nice little group. And Carl was about to, you know, push down the shutter when all of a sudden Sloane appeared from the crowd rear in a Seahawk upside down at Liverpool Airport, making a noise and spoiling the photo for him nicely. So I don't think he's quite forgiven me for that, but it's always always some good chat with Gareth.
Well, listen, Ian, thank you so much for your time today and sharing your story with us. A fabulous journey, and I'm sure you're still on it by the sounds of things, but thanks so much.
That's absolutely my pleasure, Peter. Great to speak to you.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
There are some really good and detailed articles on Ian Sloane available on the internet, including Flying the Seahawk by our very own Gareth Stringer on globalaviationresource.com. There are also several articles on his work with the French Navy, at the Fleet Air Arm Officers Association, and in the Navy News. I'll put links to all of these in the show notes. If you're interested in flying fast jets, and particularly the Super Étendard, they're really, really good. Well, that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. We'd also like to thank Mick Oakey and his team at the Aviation Historian for helping to promote the programme. Big thank you to Amy for providing Extended with our communication system today to record the episode. If you enjoyed this and want to comment on the show, please leave us some feedback on your podcast playing app, like and score us on our Facebook page, or just come over and say hi on our Twitter page. You can find Extended now on all popular podcast players, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Player, FM and Podbean. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. You can find Tim at RAESTimR on Twitter, and you can find Gareth at Gareth_Stringer on Twitter as well. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and of course hanging around on our Facebook page, as well as our Twitter feed as well. So that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended!
This is XTP Media.